I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
If you're working as an accountant and you lose your job, nobody really notices.
Leinster could offer me $5 million, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Moore!
Rugby weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh!
Oh! Magic!
With all the inevitability of Leinster rolling on to yet another Pro 14 title, the 42 Rugby Weekly Extra is back on this Monday morning. Hope everyone is keeping well. Murray Kinsella here, and I'm joined as ever by Owen Toolan on the line from Melbourne. How's all, Owen? You must be getting really excited to get over to Japan at this stage, link up with your new club, Kintetsu Liners. What's the story there?
Yeah, they've just gotten games underway. Actually, they played their first preseason game last week, so it was funny watching the game remotely. But guys are slowly starting to get back in, and there was an article the other day about allowing elite athletes into the country, such as Bowden Barrett. So I assume I fit that bill, and we'll be going over with those guys. So yeah, hopefully not another couple of weeks till I get over and get up and running. But still a good lead in till top league doesn't start till January next year. So plenty of time to get my feet on the ground over there. But can't wait to get stuck in.
Yeah, now that you're allowed exercise for another hour a day in Melbourne, you'll be an elite athlete in no time.
Delighted. That extra hour a day makes a big difference, I tell you.
Yeah, it's crazy scenes over there. Listen, at least we have our rugby to discuss as always, and loads again this weekend. Let's start with the Guinness Pro 14 final. As we mentioned there, Leinster dominant winners over Ulster, 27-5 scoreline in the end. Third consecutive title, 25th consecutive win in all competitions in terms of back-to-back wins. It's ridiculous levels of depth in the squad. Individual performances are really at an all-time high. Every time they make a change, it seems to work out. How impressed were you, Owen, with this performance in a general sense from Leinster?
Yeah, probably really impressed with their defensive effort, to be fair. I thought they denied Ulster, who had a huge amount of possession. If you think they got past six phases on 13 occasions in the game, but only managed one try, and that was really from a kind of unstructured possession source. But just their sheer dominance in the contact, really, especially in their D-zone defence, just the amount of double tackles they put on Ulster ball carriers, and for all of Ulster's efforts, and credit to them, because I thought they really laid it on to Leinster and did cause them issues at times and sustained periods of pressure. But I thought for Leinster to make 200 tackles and only miss 15, and as I said, deny Ulster on several occasions in the D zone, I thought it probably was a great reflection of their culture, and despite the fact that their attack isn't firing on all cylinders and probably isn't getting a huge amount of fluidity, which we'll probably touch on a little bit, owing to their line out malfunctioning at times, which denies them those initial entry points into the game. But I just thought it was a huge defensive effort, and for everything Ulster gave, they just couldn't seem to penetrate them outside of that first try early on.
Yeah, and it was a great start for Ulster. Jack Conan with the turnover loses the ball forward, and you see the turnover mindset from Ulster. McCluskey making yards up the right, and then could see a really good feet and offload as they encounter that bit of line speed. Three defenders out from the ruck for the first time. He does well to maintain the flow. I thought Alan O'Connor had a nice bit of awareness to link out the back to James Hume, and it's a brilliant finish from a guy who's only 22, and like, that's exciting for Ulster to have young players like that emerging. He does well to get outside. Kelleher surges that acceleration, and then nice little kind of hitch kick to take him past low. He fends Keenan. Lovely stuff to start, and showed what Ulster have been good at all season in terms of their handling, in terms of being able to move the ball and get into shape nice and early. But from there, it was all about Leinster's defence. You touch on double tackles in the 22 there. I just want to go back to it. Like, what did you see them doing well in a defensive sense? Were there unique things to how they did this, or was it just a mentality thing?
I think particularly in their D zone, they worked around the corner incredibly hard. And essentially an A-zone attack, Ulster's attack is trying to beat defenders around the corner, but I just thought they were running into brick walls of Leinster defenders, and every time probably Ulster became a little bit predictable in the fact that they were attacking Leinster's 3-4 defenders, which is an area of strength really in a defensive line, and kind of enabled Leinster to predict those ball carriers and get their doubles in. And it was just a huge amount of physicality, and I thought they picked and chose their moments to attack breakdowns really well. And other than that, they had 15 men on their feet, but I thought Ulster probably just lacked a little bit of creativity in that area and didn't quite attack Leinster, probably around the 1-2 defenders, which I thought they needed to do at times just to try and shorten the Leinster defensive line, because it just for all money looked like Leinster were just beating them around the corner defensively and Ulster were just running out of ball carriers. I think just before halftime, Ulster went to a line at Maul and then went around the corner on six occasions with their forwards and eventually their forwards just ran out of steam and it was due to a huge amount of physicality in defence. And when you look at the profile of that Leinster pack, they've got so many abrasive and big athletes that just enable them to be so physical in the contact, and Ulster just weren't able to match them. But I thought they demonstrated a huge amount of hunger, as I said, working around those corners and showing up and probably showed up Ulster's lack of creativity. When you look at Leinster's, that Dyer's try in the second half, it comes from a line against the grain, going back against the same way shape. And those little subtle lines are so important to break down like world-class defences. And I think you can say of Leinster's defence that it is truly becoming a world-class defence at club level. And Ulster just needed a little bit more creativity to break them down.
Because Leinster do have those subtleties around their power game. Like, obviously, they've got some exceptional athletes, as you mentioned there, but there is those shifts of angle back against the grain, as you say, a little decoy, maybe the nine scooting. And I did think we'd see a little bit more of that from Ulster. You think of Mathewson, I know it was a different situation. It was slightly broken up, but he scoots early enough in the game and he gets yardage. I think Cooney did it once when he came on. I thought we'd see a little bit more of it because that line speed from Leinster, you know, I'm talking about the third, fourth defender, you've mentioned it there, but Van der Fleer, obviously, his red scrum cap is the image that's seared on everyone's brain after that game, because he's just going relentlessly with the line speed there. And almost like, you know, we always talk about kind of a uniform line speed, but that's not Leinster's concern. It was getting massive line speed onto that first receiver. Think of the number of times where Billy Burns is just literally shipping the ball on without barely even looking to his outside, because you know he's going to get smashed ball and all otherwise. And that pressure told. Even I think of the period before half time, yeah, where they play around the corner and eventually they create a bit of an overload on the right hand side, and Burns tries to go out the back to James Hume, but it's a really poor pass, and there's the back three loaded outside Hume, and an opportunity potentially for one of them to go one on one and create something. So the Leinster defence just got in the eye line and in the mindset, and you've mentioned there, like, having 15 defenders on the feet, they're so quick off the ground, and that gives them the scope to have the two in the backfield as well, the 13 up front and two covering backfield. So they, even like for me, you know, Ulster's attacking kicking game maybe wasn't really a factor at all in the game. I thought they actually did well with some of their aerial stuff under the box kicks. They had some big wins, and then I thought they did well to not overdo that, as we saw Munster doing. They actually played and they built up well and they got into the 22. I think they had twice the number of possessions in the 22 that Munster did. So as you say, they got into those areas, but just lacking those bit of subtlety just to find the finishing touch. What did you think of, I had to ask you about them not kicking a goal before halftime, leading up to that error from Burns to Hume. Did you think they could have maybe taken the points, or do you have to score tries against Leinster?
Exactly that. I think, Murray, that probably their mindset was that going 3-6-9 probably wasn't going to get it done against Leinster, and they needed to turn that kind of territorial dominance into tries, really. And I don't think you can really blame Ulster for that. They felt they had a little bit of dominance at line-out time as well, and you got to go with those calls. I know it's a final, and the traditionalists will say you take your points when they're on offer, but I think to beat a side of the calibre of Leinster, you're probably going to need to be scoring tries. And I think if you touched on it a little bit, Ulster just looked a lot more dangerous in the unstructured stuff rather than their structured play. And that's something we've talked about a little bit, Murray, isn't it? That they do get a little bit point to point, especially against a line speed team like Leinster that kind of thrive on that structured attack. They can pick off the would-be ball carriers quite easy. It obviously comes to fruition in the second half with Henshaw's read on Burns for the intercept, and I think that's probably the next layer to Ulster's evolution, really, isn't it? Is trying to create more layers to their attack, trying to become a little bit less predictable attacking the line. If they're going to play that prescribed shape, they really do need two ball players. I think it's very tough to rely on your 9 and 10 as your playmakers without really an extra facilitator in that back line. I think for all of Stuart McCluskey's efforts, I thought he was phenomenal again for Ulster, and he is creative through contact, but he's not a ball playing second receiver that can unlock defences with a running or kicking game. And I think that's really where Ulster need to evolve is trying to unlock defences, whether it's through a second ball player or playing a little bit flatter and bringing in your game breakers. I thought Stockdale was, that's the best I've seen Jacob Stockdale from an offensive perspective in a long time. His aerial threat, as you've already mentioned, caused Hugo Keenan a lot of trouble. And every time he gets the ball, he looks like he's going to beat defenders. And I thought it was a great matchup with James Lowe as well. There was real physicality any time those two came together. And to be fair, I thought Stockdale came out on top. And what I'd just love to see him more is just him hunting off his wing more, looking for possession, even up at first receiver. Ulster play like really, really nice interplay with their forwards. A lot of in passes, so from the middle ball carrier back to the inside forward runner. But what that does is it doesn't cut off defenders. So it's not cutting off Leinster's defensive line while it's giving them momentum. It's not actually cutting numbers in defence. And it's off those little tips that Ulster need to start to flatten up and playing on top of Leinster when they get those little momentums. And I think it would be great to see them evolving to that, because undoubtedly when it becomes unstructured and they can get their arms through contact, they were causing Leinster problems. And I think there's plenty to build on. I thought it was a real heroic effort. And I know Josh Van der Flyer got man of the match, but I thought Sean Reedy was unbelievable and was probably my man of the match in a losing team. I think he made 23 tackles, which is more than the other two back rows combined for Ulster. And he was Ulster's leading ball carrier as well, I think, with 18. So he put on a huge display as well for Ulster. I was really impressed with him. So a lot for Ulster to be proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. The second playmaker thing is interesting. And Michael Lowry will obviously hope to grow into that player. Obviously still young and learning, and he had a long-term injury, so maybe not as assertive yet as he will become. I think that's a brilliant point on Jacob Stockdale. I'm looking at my notes in the first half, and I just having block caps give the ball to Stockdale. And it is on him, I suppose, to insert himself in those positions and be encouraged to do that, because, like, wow, he looked aggressive and dominant in his mindset any time he touched the ball. You think of him kick-returning against Lowe, as you say, and putting on a really nice bit of power into that initial tackle. I think Lowe did cling on and bring him down, but he just looked so aggressive. And even we'll come to the Rebels Reds game, but I look at how Marika Corabetti has developed into that consistent presence off the 9 or off the 10, like around the rucks, and I think Stockdale can really add so much to that. Get your most dangerous players into the game all the time, not just waiting out on the width. Obviously that's an important part of their job to finish, but I think it's a really good point. We have to talk about the Leinster attack, of course. I suppose just briefly to mention, the penalty count did go against Ulster, and in a final that matters, 16-13 in the end. And a number of them, for me, were unbelievably soft penalties, letting Leinster out of their defensive zone. You think of the two restarts where they gave up silly penalties, a scrum penalty down the 22. They're just easy outs for a team of Leinster's class, and I think that would have really infuriated Ulster looking back on that. But Leinster didn't. They didn't fully exploit it, particularly in the first half. They lost four of their 16 throws overall, and it was damaging on, wasn't it? What did you see around that? Because always the hooker obviously is going to get blame initially, but it looks like there could be a bit more at play.
Yeah, a lot of movement in the line out, and it appears to be a throw jump system where you're obviously relying on a huge amount of timing from lifters and jumpers to connect with the throw. And to be fair, a lot of the throws looked like they were at top of jump, and there, I know Cullen mentioned it after the game that there was some timing issues, and you just wonder whether they needed that movement. Again, they didn't seem to be under a huge amount of pressure, the jumpers in the air, and there seemed to be a lot of variation to their movement, but it denied them flow. And it was kind of interesting when I was thinking back to the game, is we've obviously seen this run to kick mentality for Leinster where they're trying to play that territorial game and having variation to their starters. You think of that line out, they ran it twice with James Gibson Park at first receiver. First time they go wide to Ringrose, who puts a really, really good kick through and forces Little as the blindside winger to cover across 60 metres to get the ball, and then also forced to kick out. But then Leinster lose that line out. And I think that's what's denying them a little bit of flow. If you're going to play that territorial battle, then you want to leverage your set piece to be able to strike off, and that lack of continuity with their set piece probably denied them that little bit of rhythm to play their structured attack. So it's interesting. They've obviously come out of the lockdown with this run to kick mentality and playing a territorial battle, but you really do need your set piece to be firing to kind of, I guess, make the most of that territorial gains you're making.
Yeah, and that's the scary thing. If the lineout's firing in the first half, for me, then like game over by half time, to be honest. That example there is a brilliant one, where they're in a prime position to force their way over, and usually they're so good in those positions. Even when they did get into some of those positions and had their possession source work out okay, there were scrappy bits of it which you just don't associate with them. You think of them as a team who always take their chances inside the 22, but a few issues again around the attacking breakdown and entry and off feet, and I think there's a bit of frustration there with how it's not quite flowing yet. That's certainly something for them to work on, but the line out will be a big part of that. And I mean, I'm looking back on it, and yeah, you mentioned the timing. Like, there's one where Van der Fleer probably is just a little bit late coming from receiver to lift as the throw comes in. James Ryan definitely got confused on one of them at one stage. He's obviously just back. And you just think for this week, I know Saracen's line out defence is excellent, but they'll probably simplify it slightly and go back to basics on that. So it'll be interesting to see how Saracens attack them in that sense. I want to ask you about the individual performances, because we often end up talking about collective stuff and tactics, but obviously how players play individually is a massive part of this. And it just seems with Leinster at the moment, Owen, that like when I go through their team list from this game, every single one of the players is either very good or impressive or strong performance. And then maybe on the Ulster side, there's a couple there who are quieter or maybe just decent in a final, but Leinster seem to be getting the absolute utmost out of their individuals.
Yeah, particularly the back row. I thought their back row is a collective, that balance we've talked about before. And Jack Conan probably didn't get a huge amount of headlines, but he was Leinster's number one ball carrier with 11. And I think he was their number one tackler with 20. So he's doing a huge amount of work for them. And obviously we've talked about Caelan Dyers and that double effort, if you like, in the A zone, that carry then gets to his feet and runs that line against the grain to plough through two former Leinster teammates and Geordie Murphy and Madigan, and just shows his athletic prowess close to the line. He just has that power and contact, and their contact skills are excellent. When you look when they do get into the A zone and they go through phases and they get their breakdown right, like when you're going Keane Healy, then Andrew Porter, then you've got James Ryan and Keller. And I've got it in my notes that it wore Ulster down, whether they got the try then or it was the next passage of play they get the try. It's just it takes its toll on defenders, and they've just got such an array of ball carriers in their pack that I thought they were really, really, really impressive. And as I said, probably just worked really hard for each other as a collective. I didn't think there was a huge amount of standout performance from an attacking perspective, but just complemented each other really well.
Yeah, absolutely. Told Robbie Henshaw actually was quietly very good again. He's been very dynamic. He looks like maybe he's lost a bit of weight or something. I'm not sure. He looks a very dynamic, nice little change up, and he's carrying very well alongside all those forwards. Obviously, Gary Ringrose stood up well as captain, and some really good defensive interventions. But just the competition for places is driving performances. Andrew Porter's been one of the best players since the restart, and Tyke Furlong still to come back. Like, Tyke Furlong must be worried about his spot. At open side, it's obviously ridiculous. Van der Fleer's man of the match here, and Will Connors has been sensational for 2 weeks. Dan Levy's still to come back, and Scott Penny, one of the most exciting young back row talents in Ireland, he must be worried about getting any minutes at all. People are taking their chances. Even Ed Byrne off the bench was sensational again. He's making such an impact, and to me looks like a test prop in the waiting. So it's just brilliant for us, or Leinster rather, to have that competition. And then I guess just finally a word for Leo Cullen, Owen, a guy who took more than his fair share of flack at the start of his reign, I suppose, with Leinster. It was obviously, he got the job much sooner than he expected, but he really has overseen this very calmly and with, I suppose, great planning, it seems, from the outside.
Planning's a great word, especially they're probably having to contend with more absentees from an international perspective during those windows than any other team, and to go unbeaten in a season 15 from 15, it hasn't been done before in the Pro 14. I think it was an incredible achievement, and I'm not sure the number of players they've used, whether it be in the 40s or something along those, like 53. which is a huge number as well. And yeah, just, as you said, it one points to the depth of their squad, but also the ability of the head coach and the coaches to try and to keep the group happy and hungry and reward form, which I think they've done a pretty good job of. And a huge amount of credit has to go to the coaching staff, because it's obviously been a punctuated season with the COVID break, and to get back up and running and not perform at their best, but to still come away with consecutive wins, I think it's a really good reflection of where the group's at. And credit to all involved.
Yeah, they really are a model of best practice at the moment. And Colin cares so much about what's going to happen in the future as well. You can see him planning longer term down the line. Lancaster, obviously a brilliant appointment, who's, they've just worked seamlessly together. And even Lancaster as well is working on academy players and clubs and schools coaches. So geez, the success is really going to roll on. But looking from this point, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens this coming weekend, though. Saris are up this much anticipated European quarterfinal, and they had a big win over Exeter in one of these just shite Premiership matches. They've been awful to watch, and quickly losing interest because there's some real mismatches there. Interesting to hear Alex Sanderson afterwards, though. He's talking about, listen, Saracens know we're massive underdogs. We've got a few tricks up our sleeves, and maybe there's a seed of doubt in Leinster minds because we've beaten them in Europe before. How do you think Leinster are going to be feeling about this one, Owen? And do you see, like, despite Owen Farrell missing for Saracens, despite the changes in the clubs, do you see them having the tools to really trouble Leinster in this game?
Absolutely. I think they would have targeted this game ever since the relegation was announced in the Premiership, and all games in the Premiership were by nature a kind of dead rubber for them, that all their focus has been on this game. And I think they will have put a huge amount of time and resources into scouting Leinster, looking back about what worked well when they beat Leinster, and obviously having watched Leinster for the last 4 weeks, I know you've chatted about them, Leinster potentially of holding some stuff back from a structured perspective, but that with the quality of players they have, I think Mario Toje, Cruz, Vunipola, like a huge amount of quality up front. It's almost a test pack, isn't it, Jamie George? And Leinster are going to have to be on point. Obviously, their lineout is going to come under a huge amount of pressure now, given what they've displayed the last few weeks. So Saracens will look to exploit there. And then the aerial threat, as we discussed, Ulster's entry points into the game, a lot of it came from Jacob Stockdale, contests over the top of Hugo Keenan, and Saracens will have watched that. They put a huge amount of emphasis on their kicking game, and this is it for them. This is their biggest game for the next year. So they'll have really targeted, and I think it's going to be a hugely attritional game. And yeah, just hope Leinster can kind of click up another gear from an attacking perspective and pose some different questions of Saracens that potentially they haven't posed in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, they absolutely need to. And it's a funny thing, you know, they're celebrating a title success, but they haven't been as good as they can be. I don't think anywhere near it really with Leinster. So that's a nice position to be in a way, but definitely with concerns over what Saracens can do and some of those weapons you mentioned. That is going to be just a brilliant European tie, and I've been looking forward to it for months. The other big European Cup quarterfinal to mention is Ulster trying to bounce back immediately against Toulouse, who had, I actually watched their game. They had a 39-23 win over Ron O'Gara and John O'Gibbs La Rochelle there on Saturday. Some stunning attacking rugby, most notably, if people get a chance to watch the highlights, the last try for Gatun, some brilliant offloading and support play off the ball. But they also, Chesan Colby, he scored a brace. He's still got those magic feet. They did also kick 6 penalties, and they were taking their points and showing a bit of a knockout rugby mentality, which was interesting. But you mentioned their Ulster strengths, and I think given Toulouse's strengths as well, this could be a very, very fun game to watch, because both are going to want to play and pass and offload and attack. How do you see this one going?
It'll be tough, obviously, going down to France to play, and it'll just, I wonder how much the final has taken out of Ulster. Obviously, a huge emotional toll would have been taken out of that semi-final win to win in dramatic circumstances and then play Leinster and leave it all on the line. And as I said, they made over 165 tackles in the game, which is a huge amount. And they obviously don't have as deep a squad as some of the bigger superpowers. So it'll be huge emphasis on recovery this week. And yeah, Ulster go in with no expectations. And I think for Ian Henderson to have played a game, I think he'll come back next week in really good shape, and he'll be so important to them. And yeah, you obviously don't want it to become too unstructured against Toulouse. I think they thrive under that environment. But I think Ulster gone to the south of France before, if you look at what they did to Clermont, was it last year in Europe, they played exceptionally well. And I don't think it's going to hold any fear to them, and they can give it a rip, can't they? They've really got nothing to lose and probably not expected to come away with a win.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun either way. The other big kind of knockout rugby over the weekend was down in your neck of the woods in Australia. And I mean, I hope people have stuck with this competition, Super Rugby AU, because for me, it's just got better and better as it's gone along, obviously with players building cohesion and building form. But the rugby has been really excellent the last few weeks. The Reds beat the Rebels 25-13 to qualify for the final against the Brumbies. I guess in a broad sense, zone, how are the Reds better in this game? Brad Thorne's men advancing into the final.
Yeah, to be fair, I thought the Rebels started out really well and were really causing the Reds some problems. They showed a huge amount of width in their attack, which they'll probably come in for a little bit of criticism in Australia about being a little bit narrow in their attack. And in that first 10 minutes, they played a real kind of second playmaker type game where they were going edge to edge and finding lots of real estate in the 15-meter channels and were the dominant force in that first 10 minutes. And it took a Jordan Pate intercept off. Again, it was a Matamua pass aimed for Billy Meeks, with I think Rebels would have had a 4-on-1 down the left edge, and Jordan Pate just makes a really good read and gets the intercept, and that kind of got Reds a foothold in the game who really hadn't fired a shot. And it was kind of, there was not much in that first half. It was end-to-end stuff. The Reds were undone by a couple of injuries. Jordan Pate went off with a shoulder injury, and then Chris Fairway-Sortia went off moments later, so that they lost two backs in the first 20 minutes, and that denied them a little bit of momentum. And they were actually under a little bit of pressure at scrum time as well, which would have been another surprise. The Reds set piece has been really strong in the Super Rugby AU, but the Rebels did a really good job there, I thought, and got some dominance, and it went into the break 10-10 at halftime, and you would have had to have said the Rebels were probably the stronger side. But there's a couple of key injuries just at the start of the second half. Dane Haile-Petty, it looks like he strained his groin, and then 10 minutes later Matt Tamua goes off, and they are really critical to the Rebels' kind of game shape. They're two leaders in the back line. They managed the game with their kicking and running game, and when those two went off, you feared for the Rebels. But to be fair, it was edgier seat stuff. It was kind of end-to-end. He said the rugby was really, really good, and it took a brilliant Reds try to kind of break free. It was Taniela Tupou, the tight head prop. He plays 80 minutes every week for the Reds, which is just ridiculous. And it's we talk about Jacob Stockdale trying to get involved in the game. If he just watches the inside line from Tupou off Bryce Haggerty, it's a ridiculous running line from the tight head prop just to show his pace. And then, as we've talked about his ball skills before, just a lovely pass to Danguna on the edge to seal the game for the Reds. But it was a one score game going into those last 5 minutes, and the Rebels really, really did push them close. And I think it was a big kind of landmark victory for the Reds. A lot of young, inexperienced players in that squad, and their temperament were tested. As I said, they've gone through a little bit of adversity in the game, losing Pate and Fairway Sortia, but to keep their composure and they got their scrum back going in the second half again, which I thought gave them a lot of field position in that second half and denied the Rebels a little bit of momentum. But probably the two forum teams have made the final now, with Brumbies and Reds, and the Reds haven't run one down in Canberra in a long time, and it's going to be a massive affair now this weekend.
Yeah, I can't wait for it. Taniela Tupou is worth another mention, and we've discussed him before, but like, we've talked about tight heads redefining roles and stuff, but this guy is literally the last guy in the backfield on 22-meter restarts to run back. I mean, it's just, he's changing what tight heads can do. He's such a playmaker, and he's just such an enjoyable player. He just seems to love being out there. He loves running into people. And he did well at the scrum, as you mentioned as well, after being probably questioned in that department in the build-up by the Rebels and his penalty count there. He's just a wonderful player. I thought the Salakai Loto try as well was excellent from the Reds, where they go down the left-hand side again. Probably a lesson for the Rebels in wasting bodies in that breakdown, because Magne gets a really good shot on. They get a dominant tackle, and it's so tempting to chase in after. I think it's Meeks and Walisi who go in after the ball. They don't get it back, and then they're just numbers down.
Hunter with Paisami breaks with the show through. That's his favorite play from his time down in Melbourne. You never buy a dummy off Hunter Paisami, but he's brilliant at it. He's been a revelation in Super Rugby AU as well, and has been rewarded with a call up to the Wallaby squad, and just goes to show what form he's shown in the competition. And yeah, it was a searing break from him to find Dangunu with Salah Kailoto in support. And that's another one, Dangunu's kind of broken onto the scene. I thought he was electric with ball and hand, but the other side of his game, which he definitely wouldn't be renowned for, he came up with three jackal turnovers in the game, which is phenomenal for a winger. And he's obviously worked really hard on that side of his game, and he's going to be pushing hard for a starting spot in that opening Bledisloe next month.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see him play Test rugby, and I'm really excited by this new Wallaby squad that Dave Rennie's named. 16 uncapped players. It's a real fresh slate, new start under a new head coach, 44-man squad named, and we're just waiting for the 100% clarity on those fixture dates and that, but it looks like two games and then into the Rugby Championship. What do you make of this Wallaby squad? I think the headline omissions would be Naisirani, Kuridrani and Jack Dempsey. I particularly think, you see, Naisirani is very unlucky. His form has really picked up the last few weeks. But what do you make of the squad that Rennie has picked?
Yeah, exciting. Really with one eye on the future, I think. As you said, 13 uncapped players, and I think there's another, 16 uncapped players, and there's another 13 that are less than 10 caps. So it's a huge point to the future. There's been a lot made of the under 20 players coming through in Australia, and he's undoubtedly going to give a few of those guys a start in that opening Bledisloe game. And there's chat of a couple of Australia A games as well, with Argentina coming over, probably having not played any rugby of any description before the Rugby Championship. So he's going to get to look at some of those guys in a less pressured environment. But there's a huge amount of exciting talent coming through, and it's just about giving those guys the exposure, but also not having them exposed to, I guess, a Bledisloe's challenge in New Zealand. You just don't want to, I guess, give too many guys a debut going over to, whether it's in Auckland or Wellington. But he's got a massive job in his hands, but he's really got to be able to stamp his style and how Australia are going to play it. It's a really kind of fresh impetus, and as you said, a lot of question marks about who's going to start at 10 and at a few other pivotal positions. So yeah, really excited to see them up and running. And yeah, Issy's unlucky to miss out, but it probably shows the strength of depth. We've mentioned Pete Samu before. He was unlucky to miss out in the World Cup squad, and he probably just has a little bit more layers to his game than maybe an Issy Nasrani. His base management, his reading of the game, probably a little bit ahead of Issy, but a lot of competition for places in some positions. And I think probably the key really is their announcement of being able to pick two overseas-based players, which I think is a really smart move from the Wallabies. I know they've only mentioned that it's going to be for 2020, but I can definitely see that selection criteria kind of going on into the future. And if you can get a Will Skelton back in your team, I think that would be massive. Or a Samu Karebi, Sean McMahon, these types of guys. Yeah, two world-class players into that 15, and they become really competitive again. And what it also does is probably reduces the value of those foreign-based Wallabies. If a French club now realises that an Australian player could be away for a quarter of the season, if you add in the Rugby Championship and the July series, then they become probably a less attractive position. So I think it's a really shrewd move from Rugby Australia, and it just adds a bit of strength to the Wallabies. So yeah, fascinating to see who they select in those two positions. Yeah,
that was my first thought. How pissed off are the French clubs going to be when they see this? You've signed someone on big money terms, and now they're potentially going to be gone for a long period. Just to touch on the 16 uncapped players, I mean, we've probably seen as much of this Super Rugby AU as anyone. Who could you name a couple that maybe are two or three players that you are particularly excited about going to break through with the Wallabies?
Yeah, I think Harry Wilson at number 8. We've talked about him a couple of times. He's the Axel Foley type number eight, really smart, abrasive, runs really nice running lines. Was a little bit quiet at the weekend and got taken off after about 50 minutes, but he's been really impressive. And I've mentioned Fraser McBride at seven. I think he's going to push Michael Hooper really, really hard as well. I think he's an exciting player. He's only 21, great on baller, really good in attack as well. And I think he'll push for a 23, whether he's able to usurp Michael Hooper, probably unlikely, given Rennie's going to have to leverage some type of experience, and Hooper certainly got a lot of that. I think Tate McDermott at nine, really, really exciting, has that running game that I think Australian rugby really craves in that playmaker position. And then a guy that's been out in the wilderness for a few years, James O'Connor, he's been instrumental to the Reds this year, and I think he's going to play a part in that Wallabies backline, whether it's at first or second receiver. And then a couple of young tens, Noah Loliseo at the Brumbies, Will Harrison, who's the best kicking ten in Australia. I think he was probably at about 94% during Super Rugby AU. He's going to be a really classy up-and-coming player. And then a local Melbourne kid, Trevor Hosea at lock, really, really athletic, fits that mold of that new breed of lock that can get around the pitch, really good ball skills and great line-out option as well. So plenty of young guys coming through. So it's an exciting time for Australia, but unfortunately it starts with two tests against the All Blacks. So it's straight into the fire.
Yeah, you could quickly come crashing down to earth with those games. And it'll be fascinating to see how Rennie gets that blend. I just want to actually briefly get your thoughts on something that was announced last week, was the Autumn Nations Cup finally in this neck of the woods being confirmed, and a really exciting run of fixtures involved. Fiji and Georgia joining the mix it's brilliant for global rugby, isn't it, that we have two developing nations like that with loads of rugby talent. And I know it's not the best time for Georgia, they don't even have a head coach at the moment, and they need to get that sorted, but it is good for rugby that we have these guys at the top table on.
Yeah, absolutely. Fiji, Georgia, hopefully Japan gets involved in some iteration of the Rugby Championship as well at some stage. And yeah, it's exciting. The more exposure those teams can get to top level games, you can see it in World Cups, can't you? When they play a run of 3, 4, or 5 games against Tier 1 nations, they generally tend to improve. And that's the exposure that's required. And it just gives spectators a different look, doesn't it? Just different types of games. Obviously against Fiji, it's going to be, you would hope, fast, expansive running rugby, and then the set-piece challenge that Georgia are renowned for around the scrum time as well. So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting for the spectator, and obviously on a new broadcaster with Amazon Prime coming in as well. So just gives the competition a different look, doesn't it? And I think it's just a really pivotal moment for the global game to try and reshape these kind of November windows, the July windows as well, make them more competitive spectacles with a bit more meaning to them, I think is really important, as well as I said, trying to get more of those, I don't like calling them tier two nations, but those less wealthy countries that have such an amount of rugby talent that just need more exposure to top level rugby. So it's great news.
Yeah, absolutely. And the meaningful element is really pertinent, because like that's what piques Amazon Prime's interest in this is there's a competition with a name and a trophy, and it has been a big part. Look, like I know people say, oh, friendlies in November, and it clearly hasn't been that way. They've been some of the biggest, most competitive tests around, but it is cool to have a trophy at the end of it for Andy Farrell and Ireland to go after it, and I think it's brilliant to be opening up those horizons and including people. I think broadcasting wise it's going to be fascinating how things develop going forward. I got onto Amazon Prime just for anyone in Ireland. They have confirmed that the matches will be available to watch in the Republic of Ireland as well, so that's a relief for all of us trying to watch that. But fascinating to see how that all develops over the next few months and years. But I think we're going to leave it there. And there's Mitre 10 Cup back as well, but I think it's going to take us a while to really get invested in this, because there's another 8 games or every weekend. It's going to be hectic keeping up with that.
Yeah, a lot of the All Blacks played at the weekend. So I know the Barrett brothers togged out for their local club, Taranaki, and there was quite a few. The Ione brothers played for Auckland. So there's some high scoring games and some lovely rugby to watch as well. So no doubt that'll and Canterbury continue to win, which is nothing strange for that club. So yeah, plenty of rugby, top quality rugby as well. So it's been good to watch that as well.
Yeah, my favourite was Southland beating, I think it was Bay of Plenty, yeah, in the pissing rain and massive celebrations like they'd won it. You just love to see that, the underdogs. So yeah, good on them. But listen, I'm going to finish by asking you for the prediction. So for this weekend, how do you see those two quarterfinals going?
Yeah, I'll plump for two home wins, a Leinster win and a Toulouse win, I think. But yeah, I can't wait to watch Leinster Saracens. It's probably the biggest club game in quite a long time. So Leinster will no doubt have revenge in their minds for losing in Newcastle to Saracens, and to be the first team to win five Heineken Cups. I think that's a huge card for the club, and I know the players will be really, really keen to get that fifth star on the crest. So yeah, fascinating to watch. What do you reckon, Murray? Where's your money at?
Yeah, I'm on the same wavelength as you there. I think the Toulouse Ulster game is going to open up, and I think it could be the tie of the weekend, but Leinster Saracens is going to be a test match in all but name, so can't wait. Listen, Owen, thanks a million for the analysis and the insight as always.
Cheers, good luck.
And thanks everyone for listening. We're back on Thursday as always, so we'll chat to you then.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
If you're working as an accountant and you lose your job, nobody really notices.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Moore!
Rugby Weekly.
Little reverse pass. And
you're not alive, boys, so you start kicking when the room is spinning.